Usually when we look at the grand sweep of macroeconomics, change happens really, really slowly.
Oh, yeah, it's glacial.
Exactly, it's glacial. We're talking about decades of incremental policy shifts and these really subtle market adjustments. But I want you to imagine this. For over 70 years, the entire global economy was moving decisively, almost unstoppably, really in one single direction.
Right, toward open borders.
Yeah, open borders, free trade, and just this unshakable, totally bipartisan belief that a more deeply integrated world was inherently a richer and safer world. And then, I mean, almost overnight, someone basically walked right into the engine room of the global economy, grabbed the main lever, and just threw the entire machine into reverse.
It really remains one of the most abrupt and consequential handbrake turns in modern economic history.
Yeah.
We went from this deeply entrenched, almost religious consensus regarding globalization to essentially tearing up the entire post-war rulebook in the blink of an eye. And the sheer velocity of that pivot, it's still sending shockwaves through supply chains today.
It's wild. But anyway, welcome to the Deep Dive. We are so thrilled to have you with us today as we unpack a wildly complex and, incredibly impactful piece of recent history.
Absolutely.
Our mission today is to explore a specific part of the source material, Dossier Trump 2015-2029, Chapter 8, America First and Global Trade.
A very heavy chapter.
Oh, for sure. We are going to examine the actual mechanics of that historic shift from a free trade consensus to really aggressive economic protectionism. We'll look at the central conflicts, how they played out mechanically with both strategic rivals and close allies.
Yeah, nobody's really spared.
Right. And ultimately, we'll look at the economic scorecard to figure out who the actual winners were and who, ended up footing the bill.
Which is always the most important part.
Exactly. And just as a quick baseline for you listening, because we always have to say this, we're doing what we always do here. We are stripping away the partisan rhetoric, the political noise, and we're just looking at the raw mechanics of the dossier.
Right, just the facts on the ground.
Yeah, we are analyzing the math of the global board, the how and the why of these policies, without endorsing any political side of the aisle whatsoever.
Because honestly, that's really the only way to accurately analyze this period.
Yeah.
If you get bogged down in like the daily political theater of that era, you completely miss the massive structural tectonic shifts happening underneath. We are examining how the very DNA of international commerce was fundamentally rewritten, regardless of how you might feel about the architects of those policies.
Totally. So to really appreciate the magnitude of that rewrite, we kind of have to establish what the baseline actually was, right? Let's rewind the tape to the post-World War II economic world.
Place to start.
We're talking Bretton Woods, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, all the way up to the creation of the WTO in the 90s.
Right, and that post-1945 era is just critical context for this whole thing because the United States wasn't just a participant in the free trade movement.
No, they built it.
Exactly. It was the primary architect and the ultimate champion of it. And what is vital to grasp here is that this wasn't it wasn't a wedge issue.
Yeah.
It was a deeply bipartisan consensus in Washington. You had decades of American administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, and they all treated international trade treaties, open markets, and economic globalization as this undeniable economic doctrine.
It was treated almost like a law of gravity. Like the prevailing wisdom was that you just don't argue with the gravity, you just build airplanes to utilize it.
That's a really good way to put it, actually, because
Yeah.
the overarching philosophy rested on this idea of comparative advantage. You know, the economic theory where countries specialize in what they do best and then just trade for the rest.
Right, and that stimulates massive economic growth.
Exactly. It theoretically forces competition,
Yeah.
which lowers prices, increases overall prosperity, and, creates a rising tide that lifts all boats.
Classic line.
Right. But there was a fourth, equally important pillar to this consensus, and it was forged in the immediate aftermath of two devastating world wars.
Which was?
The belief that economic integration actively prevents military conflict, the whole theory of democratic peace through trade.
Oh, right. The idea being that if two countries are just deeply intertwined, economically like. If their supply chains are heavily codependent, they simply can't afford to shoot at each other.
Exactly.
So free trade was essentially pitched as the ultimate peace project.
It was. And for a really long time, the macroeconomic data fully supported that Washington consensus. I mean, global GDP just skyrocketed. Billions of people globally were pulled out of extreme poverty, and the formula just seemed completely unassailable.
Right. But, and this is where the dossier really gets into it, it highlights that beneath those glowing macroeconomic GDP charts, the microeconomic reality on the ground was, it was quietly deteriorating for a massive swath of the American public.
It really was.
You look at the NAFTA era in the 90s, and then China's entry into the WTO in 2001, and you start seeing these severe structural fractures.
Well, yeah, because the fracture happened because macro-level prosperity often masks micro-level devastation.
Right.
The aggregate statistics showed the U.S. economy growing, sure. But the lived experience in traditional industrial heartlands was just brutal.
Yeah.
Starting in the 1990s and then really accelerating rapidly in the 2000s, which is a period economists often refer to as the China shock, the criticism of that free trade consensus began to crystallize into genuine, localized outrage.
Because the theory of comparative advantage, it assumes this level of frictionless labor mobility that just doesn't exist in reality.
No, not at all.
Like, the theory says, okay, sure, the local steel mill closes because it's cheaper to import it now, but don't worry, those workers will just transition into the new, highly profitable tech sector.
Which sounds great on paper.
Right. But a 50-year-old machinist in Ohio whose factory just packed up for Shenzhen isn't going to magically become a software developer in Silicon Valley the following week.
That frictionless transition is just the great myth of classical trade theory.
Yeah.
In reality, what people were actually witnessing were these devastating factory closures right in their hometowns. They watched the wholesale outsourcing of American manufacturing to foreign countries that had drastically lower labor standards.
Right.
And that led directly to massive, heavily concentrated losses in industrial employment, which in turn just spawned severe regional inequality. The coastal financial and tech hubs boomed, while the industrial Midwest essentially hollowed out.
You know, it makes me think of an analogy. Let's say the U.S. economy is this giant, bustling shopping mall, right?
Okay, I'm with you.
And the prices in this mall are incredibly low. Like, everything is super cheap. But the catch is that the people shopping there, they used to actually manufacture the goods themselves in the back room. And now they don't have those jobs anymore, so they don't even have the income to buy those cheap goods. The low prices don't matter if your paycheck went to zero.
That's spot on. And the dossier actually uses a very specific Dutch term here, bananenverlies, which essentially captures this deep-seated association with job loss.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it points to a profound psychological and cultural shift among the American working class.
Because the linguistic association is just everything here, right?
Absolutely. For decades, the political establishment sold free trade as basically a synonym for affordable abundance.
Right. Cheap stuff.
But for a large segment of the public,
right,
that phrase just completely mutated. It stopped meaning cheap electronics and explicitly started meaning community collapse or, you know, my neighbor's livelihood just vanished.
Yeah. It's like watching a massive corporate buyout where the shareholders, which in this case is the macro economy, get incredibly wealthy off the margins.
Yep.
But the middle management and the floor workers are just totally liquidated without a safety net.
Exactly.
And sure, the company's stock price looks great on paper. But if you're the one who just got liquidated, you don't care about the stock price. You just know the system sold you out.
Right. And if you don't have a stable income, the fact that a flat screen television is 20% cheaper at some big box store is entirely irrelevant to your actual survival.
Exactly.
That disconnect created this massive reservoir of political capital just waiting to be tapped. The electorate in those hollowed out regions felt entirely abandoned by the bipartisan consensus that had, you know, chilled this whole globalization process.
Which brings Donald Trump directly into the narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, he recognized that reservoir of anger and made this exact grievance the absolute centerpiece of his political rise.
He did.
The entire premise of America First was that the United States had been systematically dismantled and disadvantaged by decades of just terrible trade deals.
And the argument he formalized was that the U.S., with its incredibly lucrative consumer market, had essentially allowed itself to be pillaged.
Wow.
Yeah. The narrative was that other nations had spent half a century profiting off unfettered access to American consumers, while American workers and communities were left to absorb all the negative externalities of that globalization.
So you have a Rust Belt filled with voters who now explicitly associate the global trade order with their own unemployment. Politically, that anger is a loaded gun. And the weapon the new administration chose to fire to address it was the tariff,
Yes, the tariff.
which, I mean, that represents a staggering break from protocol. For decades, previous administrations treated tariffs as an absolute last resort.
Like an embarrassing failure of diplomacy to be avoided at all costs.
Right. You were supposed to use the WTO dispute mechanisms. You negotiate, you de-escalate.
That was the standard playbook for sure. But the
Yeah.
America First Doctrine completely inverted it. They basically weaponized import duties. Tariffs were no longer a defensive last-ditch mechanism. They became the opening offensive move.
Wow.
They were the primary instrument for leverage, which fundamentally marked the biggest shift in American trade policy since the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act back in the 1930s.
So let's look at the underlying logic of this, because you don't just slap taxes on incoming goods without some sort of strategic end game. What were the actual stated objectives of essentially declaring a trade war?
Well, the dossier breaks the strategy down into several interconnected objectives. First and foremost, the immediate protection of domestic industry from foreign competition.
Okay, so buying American manufacturers time and space to rebuild.
Second, it was a blunt force attempt to reduce trade deficits.
Right.
The administration viewed trade heavily through the lens of a balance sheet. Basically, if you import more than you export, you are losing.
Which is a very specific way to look at it.
It is. Third, the goal was to exert direct, painful economic pressure on foreign governments to force them to the negotiating table and change their behavior.
Leverage.
Pure leverage. And finally, the ultimate goal was reshoring.
Reshoring.
Making it so punitively expensive to manufacture abroad that companies would be forced to relocate their production capacity back onto American soil.
And to execute that, the administration put a massive spotlight on two foundational materials, steel and aluminum.
Yes, they did.
But they didn't just casually apply these tariffs, they invoked Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, which basically classified these imports as a direct threat to national security.
And the utilization of Section 232 was highly controversial, but honestly, strategically brilliant from a legal standpoint.
How so?
Well, by categorizing primary metals as essential for national security, economic independence, and strategic capacity, the executive branch could bypass Congress entirely and act unilaterally to impose these sweeping tariffs.
Okay, I have to push back on this national security justification, though, because it just feels like a massive stretch to me.
A lot of people felt that way.
Right, because I understand why a nation needs domestic steel to build, like, aircraft carriers and artillery shells. That makes sense. But we import massive amounts of steel and aluminum from Canada, from the UK, from all these historical allies. How on earth is buying rolled aluminum from Toronto a threat to American national security? Isn't this just a clever legal loophole to protect uncompetitive domestic businesses from having to actually innovate?
Well, that was precisely the counterargument made by countless economists and allied nations at the time. But to understand it, it requires unpacking how the administration expanded the very definition of security.
Okay.
The proponents of the Section 232 tariffs argued that military security and economic security are actually indistinguishable.
Interesting.
Their logic was rooted entirely in capacity. If you allow cheaper imported steel, even from a really friendly nation, to bankrupt American steel mills, those physical blast furnaces go cold.
Right.
And blast furnaces aren't like a light switch, you know? You can't just turn them back on when you need them. The infrastructure degrades, the skilled labor force disperses.
Oh, I see. You lose the institutional knowledge of the actual physical capacity to make the stuff?
The argument was that if a real global crisis hits, say a massive war, a pandemic, a total disruption of global shipping lanes, and you physically lack the industrial capacity to forge your own structural materials, you are entirely vulnerable.
Because you literally can't build anything.
It doesn't matter if your supplier is your best friend, if the supply lines across the ocean or the border are cut, you have to maintain a baseline domestic capacity to be truly secure.
Plus, I remember they were arguing that the initial competition wasn't even based on free market principles anyway, right?
That was the secondary justification.
Right.
The administration argued that the global market was inherently rigged from the start. American steel mills, which, you know, have to pay fair domestic wages and adhere to stringent EPA environmental regulations, were competing against foreign mills that were heavily subsidized by their own government.
Right. So they paid abysmal wages and had basically zero environmental oversight.
Exactly. So the tariffs were framed not as this evil protectionism, but as a completely necessary equalizer to counteract foreign state-sponsored cheating.
But, I mean, the reality of economics is that every action has a downstream reaction. If you artificially raise the price of foundational raw materials right at the border, that cost doesn't just evaporate into thin air.
No, it certainly doesn't. It propagates through the entire economy.
Right.
Critics immediately warned of the secondary effects. Because if you protect the primary metal producers with tariffs, you simultaneously punish every single midstream American manufacturer that uses aluminum or steel to build their products.
Because now their materials are more expensive.
Exactly. Whether that's auto parts, beer cans, or construction equipment. You make their inputs way more expensive, making them less competitive globally. And ultimately, that inflation just gets passed straight to the end consumer.
Yeah, we definitely get to dig into who ultimately paid that bill when we look at the scorecard later on. But while steel and aluminum tariffs definitely sent shockwaves through the global market and annoyed a lot of allies, they were largely just a warm-up act.
Oh, absolutely.
The absolute core of the America First trade policy, like the main event, was aimed squarely at one specific rising superpower.
Yeah, the entire architecture of the policy was ultimately designed to confront China.
Right.
Decades of deepening economic integration, which a lot of people assumed would slowly liberalize Beijing, it just hit a catastrophic breaking point.
So let's break down the anatomy of this strategic collision. The headlines at the time focused obsessively on the massive trade deficit, but the dossier makes it clear that the U.S. concerns were far more systemic than just, you know, Americans buying too many cheap electronics.
Much more systemic.
So if the trade deficit was just the symptom, what was the actual disease they were trying to cure?
The underlying disease, from Washington's perspective, was the systematic extraction of American intellectual property and this forced transfer of technology.
Wow.
It went far beyond standard industrial espionage. The Chinese government had basically engineered a system where access to their massive, incredibly lucrative domestic market came with very severe strings attached.
Right, the joint venture requirement.
Yes.
This is a mechanism that I think is deeply misunderstood by a lot of people. It wasn't just corporate spying in the dead of night by hackers.
No, not at all. It was entirely legalized extortion within their own system.
Right.
If a major American automotive company or a huge tech firm wanted to sell products in China, Beijing would legally mandate that they could not operate independently in the country.
They had to partner up.
Exactly. They had to form a joint venture with a domestic Chinese firm, which was often state-owned, and legally share their proprietary technology, their source code, and their manufacturing processes.
It's basically a toll booth, right?
Yeah.
But instead of just paying a tariff to get into the market, you are forced to hand over the blueprints to your most advanced technology.
That's a great analogy.
And once they have the blueprints, they learn how to build it, they scale it up with massive state subsidies, and then turn around and outcompete you globally using your own baseline tech.
Exactly. And that was the realization that sparked the bipartisan panic in Washington. Combine that forced technology transfer with massive state aid under initiatives like Made in China 2025, where Beijing specifically targeted dominance in high-tech sectors, and the U.S. saw a playing field that wasn't just unlevel, it was actively hostile.
Right.
Furthermore, the U.S. realized it had developed a really dangerous strategic dependency. They were relying on their primary geopolitical rival for critical minerals, active pharmaceutical ingredients, and foundational electronics.
I mean, think of it like an analogy for you listening.
Yeah.
Think of it like two roommates who started a highly successful business together, right?
Okay.
But suddenly, they realize they are competing for the exact same future market. And one roommate strongly suspects the other of secretly copying their code.
Yeah, the trust is just gone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They can't easily break the lease because that lease is the entire global economy. But the trust is completely evaporated. Policymakers stopped viewing China merely as a difficult trade partner and explicitly started viewing it as a strategic competitor.
And so the administration launches the trade war. They impose sweeping Section 301 tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports.
Hundreds of billions.
Yeah. And it sets off this massive escalating retaliation cycle.
Because China obviously didn't just back down.
No, they immediately implemented countermeasures. But what's really fascinating here is how targeted their retaliation was.
How so?
Well, they didn't just slap blanket tariffs on random American goods. They explicitly targeted politically sensitive American exports like soybeans, pork, and airplanes to inflict maximum political pain on the very demographics that supported the America First agenda.
Which, of course, forced the U.S. to counter-retaliate, spiraling into the largest trade conflict of the modern era.
Right.
But the key takeaway from the dossier is that as this conflict escalated, it stopped being about trade entirely, didn't it?
It did. It transcended economics and became pure geopolitics.
Yeah.
The tariffs were just the visible weapons in a much deeper structural conflict. Mm. The real battleground shifted entirely to export controls, entity lists, and restricting capital flows.
Right, going after the tech.
Exactly. The U.S. began actively trying to kneecap China's access to advanced semiconductors, artificial intelligence development, and aerospace technology.
Because you don't fight a trade war over AI and advanced microchips just to protect local manufacturing jobs.
Yeah.
You do it to protect your national security and your defense capabilities.
Precisely.
The paradigm shifted completely. Washington stopped viewing China as a necessary trading partner and officially designated them as a comprehensive strategic competitor. The whole era of engagement was basically dead.
And that single philosophical shift fundamentally altered the trajectory of the 21st century. It effectively bifurcated the global tech ecosystem and forced every other nation on Earth to start navigating this new great power competition.
Okay, so aggressively confronting a rising state-sponsored superpower makes logical strategic sense if you view them as an existential threat to your hegemony. I get that. But here's where the America First doctrine genuinely shocked the international community. If you were preparing for a generational economic conflict with China, classical geopolitical strategy dictates that you lock arms with your allies, build a massive coalition, and present a united front.
Of course.
Instead, the U.S. administration took the exact opposite approach. They weaponized trade policy against their closest historical friends.
It was incredibly jarring for the established diplomatic corps. I mean, truly. The dossier meticulously documents how traditional allies, Europe, Canada, and Mexico, were suddenly subjected to the exact same aggressive transactional pressure tactics as strategic rivals.
It's wild. Let's start with Europe, which the text accurately describes as the shocked ally.
Mm.
The European Union is arguably the U.S.'s most fundamental geopolitical partner. How did the friction actually manifest there?
Well, the European leadership was just stunned when the U.S. administration applied the Section 232 steel and aluminum tariffs against them.
Right.
From Brussels' perspective, the idea that German steel or French aluminum posed a literal national security threat to the United States was deeply, deeply insulting.
I can imagine.
But the friction points went far beyond metals. The U.S. aggressively attacked the European trade surplus. They heavily criticized European agricultural regulations that kept American products out. And they reignited long-standing disputes over aerospace subsidies between Boeing and Airbus.
And there's the massive fight over digital taxation, too, right?
Oh, yes.
Like Europe trying to tax Silicon Valley tech giants and the U.S. basically threatening massive tariffs on French wine and luxury goods in response.
It was just constant grinding economic friction. And this hostility had a profound psychological impact on the European Union.
How so?
Well, up until this point, Europe had largely outsourced its strategic economic thinking and honestly its security to the transatlantic alliance.
Right. They relied on the U.S.
The America First doctrine forced a brutal awakening. It catalyzed intense, serious discussions within the EU about the absolute necessity of strategic autonomy.
Wrong.
Europe realized, perhaps for the first time since the Cold War, really, that they could no longer blindly rely on the United States as a permanent, stabilizing economic anchor. They had to start building their own economic sovereignty.
And if Europe was shocked, I mean, imagine the whiplash in Ottawa. Canada shares the longest undefended border in the world with the U.S. Their economies are entirely fused together.
The Canadian experience was a really harsh lesson in the new reality of American politics. Despite being one of the most reliable allies and largest trading partners the U.S. has, Canada was not granted immunity.
Not at all.
The administration viewed the existing NAFTA agreement as a catastrophic failure and quite literally tore it up, forcing Canada and Mexico into an aggressive renegotiation that eventually produced the USMCA.
And the takeaway for Canada from all that was pretty stark, right?
The primary lesson for Ottawa was that under the America First philosophy, past friendship guarantees absolutely nothing in the present.
Right.
Every relationship is evaluated on a purely bilateral, immediate transactional basis.
Which is terrifying for a smaller partner.
Yeah, it forced Canada into the initial design might happen in Michigan. The raw materials are processed in Ohio. The components are then shipped down to a facility in Monterrey, Mexico for subassembly because the labor costs are lower there.
Makes sense.
Then that subassembly is shipped back across the border to Texas for advanced electronics installation, back to Mexico for final bodywork, and then finally back to the U.S. for sale.
Wow.
Yeah. A single car part might cross the U.S.-Mexico border half a dozen times before the vehicle actually rolls off the lot. It is a single, hyper-efficient, incredibly delicate manufacturing organism.
And the Trump administration looked at that organism and essentially said, this is hemorrhaging American jobs. Mm. We need to force this entire process back north of the border.
That was the absolute political mandate. They heavily criticized these transnational supply chains for incentivizing corporate outsourcing. The renegotiation of NAFTA into the USMCA was specifically designed to disrupt this flow. They implemented incredibly strict rules of origin.
Meaning what? A certain percentage of the car had to be made in North America to avoid tariffs?
Not just North America, but specifically in zones with higher wage requirements, effectively trying to mandate that production return to American factories paying those higher wages.
Oh, clever.
But the dossier correctly points out the immense complexity of doing this. You can't just legislate a deeply entrenched supply chain out of existence overnight.
Right.
The logistics are too complex, the capital investments in Mexican factories are too massive, and ultimately, forcing production into higher cost areas inevitably raises the cost of production, which raises the final price of the vehicle.
So I have to ask the obvious question that any geopolitical strategist would have been screaming at the time.
Go for it.
If your ultimate overarching grand strategy is to confront China and curb their rise, which is a monumental task that requires immense global leverage, why in the world would you simultaneously pick aggressive trade fights with your neighbors, your closest allies, and the European bloc? Doesn't that just unnecessarily isolate you and push your allies to hedge their bets?
It's the defining paradox of the era, truly. But it makes total sense if you understand the core ideology.
Okay, explain.
The America First doctrine fundamentally rejected the premise of holistic multilateral alliance structures. They didn't view global relations as a grand chessboard where you sacrifice a pawn to trap the queen.
Right.
They evaluated every single bilateral trade relationship in a vacuum. If the spreadsheet showed a trade deficit with Germany, Germany was treated as an economic adversary in that moment, regardless of NATO, regardless of shared history, and regardless of the broader unified front needed against China.
Wow, just completely compartmentalized.
Completely. Efficiency, diplomatic sentiment, and grand coalition building were entirely discarded in favor of immediate transactional leverage.
So the global board has been flipped. The rules are rewritten, treaties are torn up, tariffs are flying in every direction, allies are alienated, and a massive trade war is raging with China.
It was a busy few years.
To say the least. So when the initial dust settles from this chaotic period, we have to look at the actual measurable impact on the ground. We need to go through the dossier scorecard. Who actually survived this, who won, and who got crushed?
The economic analysis of this period is fascinating because the business reaction was just starkly divided. There were very clear winners who benefited immensely from the protectionist shield and devastating losers who were caught right in the crossfire.
Let's start with the beneficiaries. Who actually came out on top of the scorecard?
The primary winners were the heavily protected industrial-based sectors.
Right.
By heavily taxing foreign competition, domestic primary metals producers, specifically the steel and aluminum industries, saw immediate tangible benefits. Their foreign competition suddenly became artificially expensive, allowing domestic mills to raise prices, increase their profit margins, and in some cases, actually restart idle capacity.
So the blunt force protectionism actually achieved its stated goal in those specific sectors.
In a targeted sense, yes, it did. We also saw specific defense-related industries benefit from the heightened focus on national security supply chains. Furthermore, certain regional labor markets experienced a temporary but very real boost. The administration's aggressive tactics did spur some reshoring projects. We saw companies fearing unpredictable tariff hikes, actively redirecting capital investments back to domestic production, which created localized industrial job growth.
But macroeconomics is a brutal discipline, and it's almost never a zero-sum game without severe casualties somewhere else. Who took the hit?
The losers were essentially any industry that relied on global integration or foreign markets. Export-oriented companies took a massive, often existential hit because they immediately faced targeted retaliatory tariffs from other nations.
The agricultural sector really stands out here as the prime casualty, doesn't it?
It was devastating for American farmers.
Yeah.
Because the administration's political base was heavily rural, foreign nations, especially China, surgically targeted American agriculture. Tariffs on soybeans, pork, and dairy effectively closed off massive global markets overnight.
Which is just a huge loss of revenue.
Oh, the pain was so acute that the administration had to actually utilize the Commodity Credit Corporation to funnel tens of billions of dollars in bailouts to farmers just to keep them afloat.
Wait, so the government is collecting tariff revenue at the border from, like, imported steel and then turning around and using it to subsidize the farmers who were destroyed by the retaliation from that same tariff?
That is exactly what happened.
That is quite the economic loop.
Yeah.
Who else lost?
Any midstream manufacturing firm deeply reliant on international parts, automakers, machinery manufacturers, tech hardware companies, they suddenly face significantly higher input costs for raw materials and components due to the tariffs. Their margins were squeezed aggressively.
Which brings us to the ultimate silent participant in this entire saga, the consumer. The dossier outlines the stark reality of the hidden tax. Because companies don't just absorb higher costs out of the goodness of their hearts, do they? They pass them on.
Exactly. The elasticity of demand dictates that when input costs rise due to import duties, those costs cascade right down the supply chain until they reach the final price tag on the shelf.
Right.
The dossier highlights severe price spikes in very specific consumer goods, like household appliances like washing machines saw massive price increases. Electronics, vehicles, and raw building materials all became noticeably more expensive for the average consumer. Protectionism basically operates as a highly regressive hidden tax on consumption.
And this lays bare the ultimate enduring philosophical divide of this entire era. We're looking at two fundamentally incompatible visions of what an economy is actually supposed to do.
It really is the core trade-off of political economy. Proponents of the America First strategy argue that slightly higher consumer prices are a completely acceptable, even moral trade-off.
Right, because it saves jobs.
Exactly. They argue that paying an extra $50 for a washing machine is a necessary tax to ensure that a domestic factory stays open, that a community isn't hollowed out by outsourcing, and that the nation maintains the industrial capacity required for true national security. They view the economy as a tool for national resilience.
But the critics look at that exact same data and see profound inefficiency and self-sabotage.
Yep. The critics argue that you are essentially forcing the entire consumer base to pay a massive hidden tax just to artificially prop up a few politically favored industries.
While simultaneously destroying your highly competitive export sectors like agriculture and advanced manufacturing in the crossfire.
Exactly. They argue that protectionism doesn't save the economy. It just subsidizes inefficiency while sparking inflation.
It's a debate that completely transcends simple mathematics because it's deeply rooted in competing values. And as the dossier makes clear, it's a debate that didn't just end when the administration changed.
Not at all.
Which transitions us perfectly to the final major analysis in this chapter. We've looked at the chaos of the peak tariff years, roughly 2017 to 2021. But the dossier extends its lens out to 2029 and beyond, examining the long-term structural reorganization of the globe. Because despite all the tariffs, global trade didn't just evaporate, right? People still needed goods. The flow of capital didn't stop, it just rerouted.
And that is perhaps the most fascinating legacy of this period. The ripple effects of the America First policy permanently reorganized global logistics.
How so?
Well, when you introduce massive friction between the two largest economies on Earth, trade diversion naturally occurs. Countries actively seek out new, less volatile economic partnerships.
How did that global rewiring actually manifest? Like, where did all the supply chains go?
We saw massive diversification efforts across the board. Europe, feeling increasingly alienated and pressured by the U.S., significantly intensified its bilateral economic relations with Canada, Australia, India, and various Southeast Asian partners.
They sought to hedge their bets.
Exactly. And China, facing this huge wall of American tariffs and technology export controls, obviously didn't just sit still either.
No, I imagine they pivoted pretty hard.
They did. China aggressively accelerated its own diversification. They deepened their Belt and Road Initiative, strengthened economic ties with the global South, secured alternative resource pipelines in Africa and South America, and actively tried to insulate their economy from U.S. leverage.
Makes sense.
Furthermore, we saw the rise of connector economies like Vietnam and Mexico. Companies engaged in China Plus One
What
strategy.
does that mean exactly?
It means maintaining a base in China, but moving secondary production to a place like Vietnam to bypass U.S. tariffs. This effectively made those countries massive logistical hubs for rerouted trade.
So the global map is just completely redrawn. But what is the most profound, lasting paradigm shift identified in the dossier as we look toward 2029? Like, did the world eventually just sober up and snap back to the pre-2016 consensus?
Absolutely not. The paradigm shifted permanently. The rhetoric may have softened under subsequent administrations, and some of the most aggressive bilateral tactics were smoothed over, sure, but the underlying philosophy had irrevocably changed. The entire globe adopted key tenets of this new approach.
Wow. So what are the defining characteristics of this new post-America first global operating system?
The dossier identifies several permanent structural shifts. First, a permanent elevation of economic security. Supply chains are no longer viewed merely as logistical efficiency mechanisms. They are viewed as critical national vulnerabilities.
Right.
Second, a profound revaluation of domestic industrial production. The era of rampant outsourcing is just over. Governments are now actively utilizing industrial policy-like subsidies and tax credits to ensure they can manufacture critical goods domestically.
It's the realization that you can't just outsource your entire industrial base and expect to remain a superpower.
Precisely. Third, the structural strategic competition with China is now deeply baked into the international system. It is the organizing principle of 21st century geopolitics.
And finally, we see a massive, enduring push for friendshoring or nearshoring, which means bringing production physically closer to home, or at least locating it within allied nations to mitigate risk.
It really requires a fundamental shift in how we judge the success of an economy. Because for 70 years, the grand metric of international trade was pure economic efficiency.
Right.
Does this policy lower prices? Does it maximize corporate margins? Does it drive aggregate GDP growth?
But the America First doctrine, despite all its chaos, successfully forced a new metric onto the global stage, which is national interest. We no longer just ask if a product is cheap. We ask if the supply chain that produced it ensures our strategic autonomy.
Right. Does it protect our domestic labor force? Does it compromise our national security?
Exactly.
It really feels like we transitioned from a world where the only thing that mattered was how cheap a product was, to a deeply fractured world where we suddenly care intensely about who made it, where it came from, and what geopolitical leverage they gained by selling it to us. That is the perfect distillation of Chapter 8. The origin of the good became intrinsically tied to national security. Trade was permanently stripped of its utopian, peace-building veneer and firmly reestablished as a blunt instrument of geopolitics and strategic power.
Which leaves us with a whole lot to process. The dossier ends this chapter by posing a highly provocative question, and I want you, the listener, to really ponder this as you look at the supply chains governing your own life today.
It's a great question.
Go ahead and lay it out for them.
But the core question is this: was the march toward global economic integration just a historical anomaly? Has the era of unlimited globalization officially and permanently ended? Are we accelerating toward a fractured, multipolar world where the pursuit of national sovereignty consistently overrides the benefits of global economic cooperation?
Based on everything we've tracked up to 2029, I mean, we aren't retreating into entirely walled-off, isolated hermit economies. Global trade will persist. But the era of blind, uninhibited globalization, that deeply held belief that open markets and comparative advantage magically solve all geopolitical problems, that era seems to be definitively buried.
It really does.
The rules of the world economy have been fundamentally rewritten, and the ink is completely dry.
And that is the true enduring legacy of this period. America First wasn't just a localized 4-year disruption of trade flows. It was the starting gun for a completely new era of geoeconomic competition.
Now, if you thought the weaponization of tariffs and the disruption of global supply chains was chaotic, Just wait until you see how this exact same underlying philosophy was applied to military alliances.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Because if the America First Doctrine completely upended how the United States traded with its oldest, most reliable allies, what on earth did it do to the military architecture that actually kept the post-war peace?
That is precisely the explosive topic we will be unpacking in our next deep dive, looking at Chapter 9, the changing relationship between Europe and the U.S.
We'll be looking at that exact same time frame, 2015 to 2029, but shifting our lens entirely from economics to global security.
We will explore how the post-1945 NATO security blanket, which was long considered the untouchable bedrock of Western defense, came under intense, unprecedented, and highly public scrutiny.
Yeah, it got really tense.
We'll examine the bitter structural debates over the 2% defense spending rule and the incredibly transactional approach to military protection.
And we will analyze the ultimate catalyst that forced massive geopolitical reckoning, which was the shockwaves of the 2022 war in Ukraine. That just violently shattered the European security landscape.
We will detail how that conflict, combined with the lingering doubts about American commitment, forced Europe to rapidly, almost desperately, really invest in its own sovereign defense industry, sparking a massive psychological shift in how the continent views hard power.
It is going to be an absolutely fascinating discussion because it leaves us with the ultimate cliffhanger from Chapter 9, a terrifying question that European leadership had to seriously confront for the very first time since the end of World War II.
Right. And the fundamental question they had to ask themselves was, what exactly do we do if Washington ultimately decides that we are no longer a strategic priority?
We will dive deep into Europe's desperate quest for strategic autonomy next time. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you buy a product, take a look at the label. Think about the incredibly complex, highly contested geopolitical journey it took to get into your hands. And we will see you next time.